Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Genetics Podcast. I'm really excited to be here today with Gene Swidler, who's the founder, executive director, and chair of End the Legacy, which is a nonprofit patient-led organization that's dedicated to the needs and interests of the genetic ALS and FTD community. Gene has been at the leading edge of this movement for many years to treat ALS and FTD earlier, often years or decades before symptoms start. And a lot has changed in the past decade here, thanks in no small part to Gene's advocacy. But there's an enormous way to go before we live in a world where ALS, FTD, and also other genetic diseases are prevented or cured. So I'm excited to be here with you today, Gene. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this important topic.
Thank you so much for having me.
I don't think I'll do your story justice, so I'd actually really love to just start by asking you to share your experience. I know you grew up with, you know, the family where genetic ALS affected many members and obviously affected you very personally. So I'd love to just hear a little bit about the story that brought you here today and also a little bit more about this movement that you've become one of the leaders of.
Certainly. So I'll just talk about it in the frame of my own reference. So my first exposure to ALS was when my grandmother was sick and dying of it in the late 1980s. I was a small child, 6 or 7 years old, and it was truly something horrifying to witness, especially, you know, circumstances like my grandmother being in a very huge power chair in her not wheelchair-friendly home, and my grandfather totally gutting the home to add an elevator for that very huge power chair. And she sadly passed in 1990 at the age of 67. Following that, my exposure to ALS was that my mother was very anxious about developing ALS and would talk about it all the time for decades. And I and others in my family did not necessarily understand the context for this anxiety. And it just seemed out of nowhere. And, you know, from what we knew about ALS was how rare it was. And it seemed misplaced. And she wouldn't talk very in detail about this anxiety, but she would reference that she was worried about it and didn't, you know, was scared that she was going to get it or maybe she had it. That went on for decades. In 2016, right around the time I was getting married, my mother began explaining about mobility issues with her knees. She thought maybe it was arthritis, but it kept on getting worse. She had a little bit of trouble walking at my wedding in June 2016 in Lake Merritt in Oakland, California. And later that year, she fell at work. Following the falling at work, she was finally referred by her PCP, who had heard her worries about developing ALS for many years. He finally referred her to a neurologist in January 2017. My mother explained to the neurologist firmly that her mother and, unbeknownst to me, her grandfather had died of ALS and that she had seen what ALS was and she was developing ALS. The neurologist who supposedly had ALS experience did not order genetic testing, did EMGs on her both her feet and saw nerve damage and diagnosed her with peripheral neuropathy unexplained and sent her just to rehab. Over the next 10 months, my mother continued to decline. She tried very hard at physical therapy. Of course, in our ignorant understanding, we would tell her, well, listen, you were worried about this ALS thing, but the doctor excluded it. So you're not dying. It's great. Meanwhile, she understood that she had ALS, no matter what this doctor said. Over the next 10 months, she fell and broke her hip. She couldn't get off the walker after the hip surgery, and the hip surgeon accused her of not doing her exercises, but it was because she was becoming paralyzed. Her hand stopped working properly, and she started getting bulbar symptoms. And then 10 months after her first neurology visit, she finally was referred back to a neurologist to get an ALS diagnosis. I received a phone call from her. I live in California. My family's in New York. And she called and I knew she had been at a neurologist's office. And I kind of, at that point, saw the constellation of symptoms that she had and realized she must have it based on all of the different regions involved. And she told me in the saddest voice that I've ever heard, right when I picked up the phone, I was diagnosed with ALS. All I can think about is my mother hanging in a lift over a commode at my father's house while he wipes drool from her mouth and says, "Oh, look, she's smiling. I don't want that to happen to me." And that was so powerful to hear. And I knew that I couldn't tell her it wouldn't happen to her because I knew by that point really what ALS was. And, you know, it really hit me how that was probably the picture in her mind for the decades that she was expressing this anxiety about developing it. She was reliving the trauma of her mother being robbed of her dignity and, you know, being debased in front of her family by having to do all of her business at the breakfast table.
Yeah.
It's funny, I helped caregive for my mom by taking medical leave and staying in their home when she was sick. And it was not too long before she was having those moments at the breakfast table. But at that point, you know, those concerns are out the window. Concerns about decorum are easy to go away once you're living with it. But for somebody thinking about it for their adult life, I can see where that anxiety came from. My mother had a very quick progression. She died within 16 months of her diagnosis. Right when she was getting diagnosed, it was clear that my aunt had dropped feet and she, you know, she wore a boot. She did not go to the doctor to check for ALS. I spoke to her about it in that time period and she said, "Well, what's the point of an ALS diagnosis?" Finally, some months after my mother's passing, my aunt, who was the youngest of seven children, and my mother was the oldest of seven children, decided to go into the ALS longitudinal research study that I had told the family about and that I participated in following my mother's passing, the ALS Families Project at Columbia. So she allowed herself to go into the longitudinal study to be seen as an ASYMP-C9 at-risk person. But of course, when she walked into Columbia, they immediately diagnosed her with ALS because she clearly had the full phenotype. She died a few months ago, leaving my mother, my aunt, my grandmother, my great-grandfather, and through family lore, not through my direct knowledge, my grandmother's two brothers, who probably died of FTD or something like that in the 90s. So my family has had a big impact by genetic ALS and FTD. And what really struck me was that there was a drug approved to modify the disease in 1995. So why would my mother, who was fully aware of her risk and who was asking for care related to it, not be accommodated in being supported in monitoring for the disease onset and being diagnosed properly when the symptoms were quite manifest? For a random person waiting for the disease to get worse to prove it's ALS seems pretty reasonable, I suppose, but for somebody with a clear family history to make them go through that is just torturous. And there was a drug that she could have been on that would have slowed her progression, but apparently the needs of people in that position had not been a priority.
First of all, I'm sorry for your loss on both of these accounts. I mean, your aunt very recently and you taking care of your mother, it's something nobody should have to go through, but it sounds like you handled it with as much strength as you could. I want to hear how that impacted you. I mean, how did you feel during that time? But also, maybe we can also take a step back. You mentioned C9, the gene that ultimately you would have discovered is driving this family history. And it's got quite a unique role in ALS and FTD that people may not appreciate, that it would be great if you could just explain how you came to, you know, uncover this diagnostic odyssey in some extent, because there's layers to this problem you're describing. There's a diagnostic odyssey that you went on with multiple family members that many rare disease families are familiar with. This, you know, and it makes it hard to trust a doctor sometimes in the future, right? When things like this happen and you get told you have something that you don't have and there's testing available that just isn't accessed. But then there's a question beyond that, which is even if you do get diagnosed, how do we think about treatment in people before they're sick rather than not at all in this case or way later on. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that, solving the genetic mystery and what that was like for you and for your family as well.
Yeah, this first part of it, I only know through hearsay, but apparently when SOD1 was discovered, Columbia reached out to my grandfather and in the 90s and told him that his kids could get tested because they knew at that point that my grandmother and her father had died of ALS. So they knew it was a familial case. And my grandfather apparently told his children that they wanted nothing to do with that and to ignore that. Fast forward to my mom being clearly sick. I don't even know if she brought up genetic testing at first neurology appointment. And she did do genetic testing when she finally was referred to Columbia 10 months later. And they found the C9 expansion. So that was October 2017. She told us about it. And I recall just feeling like, well, I don't want to dwell on this genetic thing with her because I didn't want her to feel bad about us when she was dealing with her own terminal illness. So while she was alive, I purposely did not try to look too much into it or certainly talk about it. It was only after her passing that a comment that I'd heard that her clinic was looking for asymptomatic family members to study, did I start looking more into it.
And for those who aren't too familiar with the, you know, with the genetics and linked to the diseases, so C9 is a repeat expansion. You may be familiar with other repeat expansions like Huntington's disease. And in this case, intermediate forms of the expansion often, although not always, result in FTD or frontotemporal dementia. And then longer forms of the repeat expansion result in ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And so this is, it's a challenge from that perspective, right? Because you have to think not just about the potential ALS risk, but also FTD risk. And for a long time, I think people didn't really believe the link, right? And there were a lot of issues even with getting this link recognized until the genetics and the molecular biology was fully understood. Is that right? And did you experience some of that from your perspective?
You know, I think the repeat length is the same for both the ALS and FTD. The intermediate length is more the curious avenue for penetrance rather than either of the phenotypes.
Yeah.
So in my family, you know, my mother had documented frontal and temporal atrophy on autopsy. And I may have noticed something, but also I know, and this is something in the entire literature on cognition and ALS that I don't know has been fully explored, is that when somebody is becoming rapidly paralyzed in front of you, you give them a lot of leeway on what you consider their cognition to be because of the unbelievable stress of the situation, not to mention you're cognizant that they're not getting as much oxygen, and you know that people who don't get as much oxygen and are tired probably aren't at their best. So even if I saw something, it's kind of hard to discern what's related to the disease and what is a symptom of the disease, as opposed to being driven by the same process. I did ask her physician, who was also the attending on the autopsy, if he thought that she had cognitive impairment. And he said, you can't really be sure. She did have atrophy in her frontal and temporal lobes, a mild atrophy.
Right. I wanted to ask about your motivation for getting as involved in this field as you have, because unfortunately, many people find themselves in your position where they have generational trauma from this kind of issue and make the decision that might be right for them, that they're going to deal with it personally in their own way, and they may seek support, but they're not going to notice this fact of, hey, there was a drug available, and then dedicate years of their life to actually try to answer the question that you posed earlier, which is why wasn't this offered? Why aren't we doing this? And I know your background is as a labor organizer, and I wonder how much these two come together in an important way, that I think you are used to smashing against systems that are difficult to change, negotiating on behalf of people that are often, you know, low on the totem pole and the order of priorities in corporate America, for example. And I wanted to just pose that question and ask if you were maybe in some ways uniquely prepared for this, both personally and professionally, to think about dedicating your life to this.
I'll say only in retrospect is the clear through line becoming clear, but my professional life, yeah, I was working for the Service Employees International Union as a labor union organizer, negotiator, manager, working with hospital workers, mostly the lower paid folks, housekeepers and nursing assistants and phlebotomists and the like. But also sometimes radiology tech, respiratory therapists. And getting them to see their common interests and work together to deal with the issues that impact them. When I saw the complete vacuum that existed for the voice of the genetic ALS community, as I started poking around it after my mother's passing, it screamed out for more organization. And when Daniel Barvin posted a signpost to the Huntington's Disease Youth Organization, a longstanding organization focused on the at-risk Huntington's disease community, and asked who would want to create something like that for us, it was very easy to say, oh yeah, let's do this. Ensuring that people feel empowered and that they are trusted and that they have agency is very much how we try to conduct things with our community team at End the Legacy. And I think that helps explain why we've had people meet with us in our team meeting every Friday for 4 years with like very few off, is that people really feel like they're a leader in something, not just along for the ride. Also, the experience of negotiating with people who may not be happy that you're there may speak to the circumstance of patient advocates inserting themselves into discourse about things that, of course, they belong in because it's talking about you, that people in an academic setting may not be used or desirous of lay people, no matter their position, inserting themselves into the conversation. So I think having that experience has probably helped us a bit.
Yeah. Can you talk about that dynamic a little bit more? Because from my perspective, it's always felt obvious to me that as a researcher, or if you're creating a product or a company or anything like that, then your most important constituent is the person that, or people that you're ultimately trying to help. And I've seen the exact same dynamic that you describe, where patient advocates or lay people are kind of sidelined or marginalized. They may not know 100% of the literature in the way that the emeritus professor does, but actually in most cases, they know it even better because they've lived it and read it and helped write it in some cases. But why do you think that dynamic exists? We met in person at this International ALS Symposium a couple of months ago for the first time. And I think you've been to that meeting and others like it for years. And you've seen, I think, a big shift from you felt like you weren't even welcome in the room to things are changing, but for the better. But that's taking a really long time. Why do you think that is? Because at the core of it, what you say is very logical. Everyone wants to treat people earlier. We want to figure out a way to avoid this generational trauma and get ahead of it. But like, why is that such a difficult message, you think, for people to hear?
Well, it's becoming less and less so. So I so appreciate the reasoned consideration of so many in the field. I'll say that, the full type of ALS and FTD are so horrifying and so devastating to families and people that the grappling with the needs of people in that position as a priority is completely understandable and very reasonable. And the people studying the field had so many avenues to go down, so many things to look into in both of these instances, that perhaps some of the more simple things relating to the at-risk community could be forgiven for not getting a full airing until more recently. And on some level, that's on us. We did not organize ourselves and we did not demand that our issues be heard. And I don't think we could have expected anyone else to be pushing on them other than us. So that was our bad, and we're changing it now. For instance, through our persistent advocacy and through the forward-thinking leadership of Dr. Terry Hyman-Patterson and Dr. Michael Benatar, a workshop on the care needs of the at-risk community was just held in Pennsylvania in September. And many of the things that we care deeply about, not necessarily radical departures on pharmaceutical use, but reasoned considerations of the needs of people in these positions, had a wonderful airing, and a white paper will be coming out about it. And I look forward to it.
So we're making progress. What are, if you look at the biggest issues holding this field back right now, what would you say they are, your top two, top three, however you think about organizing it?
Well, I think raising the collective consciousness of the people who are at risk and these families impacted, as that they have interests, they have unique interests, is probably the most important thing right now. They have been hearing that their job is to sit quietly, not think about it, not think about this risk, maybe participate in research, and just wait for the miracle cure to be handed to them.
Yeah.
And I don't think that is probably the best idea for our community, and that there might be, even in absence of a cure, common sense things that people could be doing that are as simple as seeing the doctor once a year in relation to the risk. That could have a profound impact, but only if we are united and speaking together. Another top priority for us is ensuring that any risks associated with that knowledge are minimized, so that common sense rules based on limiting genetic discrimination are implemented or acknowledged by everyone, especially regulators and legislatures. And finally, we are so eager to find a cure. We know there's so many dedicated people in labs and in clinics, you know, researching this stuff and trialing these things. We are just ever going to be a foot in the camp of, well, let's take whatever biomarker tools we have now, whether they're perfect or imperfect. Let's establish what substances are in trial that have a decent safety profile and people can provide informed consent to. And let's trial these drugs that we're testing earlier in the disease and those with clear biomarker signs of disease activity. So I think those are like three headlines that we are working with.
I'd like to go through those in order and just have a little bit of a dive into them. What's the biggest impact you think there? It's obviously groups like yourselves that you run these weekly meetings that people can join and talk to other people like them and get a perspective. I guess it's also neurologists and primary care providers, right? Are those the two biggest levers? And I would suspect in the second, you know, healthcare provider sphere, there's an enormous range of perspectives on this, from people who've been treating at-risk patients and very supportive of this for many years, to people on the complete other end of the spectrum where they want nothing to do with it. And as a patient, it can be a little bit of a roll of the dice, right? Of who you end up with. And you may not know that there's a whole spectrum of opinions out there, right?
Oh, certainly. And our friend, Dr. Terry Hyman-Patterson, and our community expert, Dr. Michael Benatar, did a survey of Neil's sites asking about what they do with at-risk people. And they got a huge range of answers on if people see any and how many they see. And it was interesting, even the people who say they do see people at risk, you know, listed that they have, you know, less than 10 people they see a year or something. You know, there are hundreds of thousands of people with these genes. So even people who think that they are being very open on the topic probably are not seeing anywhere close to the amount of people in five blocks around their clinic that right, they could be. I think building consensus within the field is where it's going to be. I think this white paper, other projects that Dr. Benatar has, other projects that other people have, will be good to narrow that range down. Because right now, and historically, I think most people have been operating on assumption, even in the field or their own analysis, that no one has been guiding a conversation. So this would be the first time that there's guidance for people to rely on, which will hopefully standardize what people are hearing.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess a big part of that is the genetic testing question. And then we can also talk a little bit about your second big pillar around, you know, insurance and other impacts of this. We've been collaborating on this project called Light the Way that I've mentioned on the podcast a couple of times, which is a genetic testing program that's really been architected to purposely include as broad of a range of people as possible in this asymptomatic potential at-risk category. One of the things that was very eye-opening for me talking to a number of different people in the UK was the different perspectives on how people felt like the system over here should be navigated. It's really different in that the UK is going for national scale genetic testing and is pretty progressive in that front. And in theory, there's pretty broad ALS panels that are available. But you know, we talk to clinical geneticists, for example, that say, oh, the people who in this at-risk category should absolutely come talk to us and we can help them figure out how to navigate getting access to testing. But the problem is nobody's sending them to the clinical geneticists. The GPs and the neurologists aren't all operating off this same playbook. So I think it's in desperate need of some kind of unifying set of principles, right? And it sounds like that's something you've already been thinking of and working on.
Yeah. And Dr. Al-Chalabi and Dr. Turner were at this workshop and got their input in. And hopefully whatever comes out in this guidance is usable across the world.
Yeah, and I guess one of the big, you know, one of the major parts of this decision is the genetic non-discrimination. You're doing some work, I think, in South Carolina and also thinking about doing it federally in the United States. Maybe you could talk about the problem a little bit here, because it's, in, I think, probably one of the top on people's lists that come and speak to you and your group when they're trying to navigate this decision. And, you know, it's something I've wondered about my whole life as a genetics researcher, how we're going to solve this problem, because for the rare disease community, it's an enormous one to have this hanging over your head that you may, you know, you may suffer discrimination for the rest of your life based on some kind of predictive diagnosis. So maybe you can talk a little bit about what you see as a solution or potential solution there.
Yes. And I would say for us, we know we're not going to be going, changing laws in states and federally or having input on them alone. We're always eager to be in concert with others and happy to be stimulating conversation and ideas and being part of coalitions moving things forward. In South Carolina, I hesitate to say that And the Legacy has done much for that. Really, one of our dedicated volunteers who's been in 90% of our meetings over 4 years was able, through personal dialogue, to recruit senior members of the South Carolina legislature to introduce a bill to expand genetic non-discrimination along the lines of the Florida law that got passed a few years ago. And, you know, that was just the hard work of this one member and leadership in the state legislature. And I think we're just giving people a space to do this work. Already in South Carolina, there's a coalition with at-risk cancer groups. I had the pleasure of being connected with FORCE. I don't know if you've ever heard of that organization, Facing Our Risk of Cancer Empowered. And Lisa Schlesinger, their staff person for legislative issues, has sourced people to speak in the hearing on Thursday. And we really think that that sort of coalition work is going to be what would take for a federal push as well. One item that we are thinking about, and I think everyone should consider, and I'm not saying this is definitive, but GINA, as is written for employment and health insurance, covers genetic testing and family history. The expansion of genetic testing protections in Florida covered just genetic testing. And there is a difference between the two. For instance, you cannot counsel people on their family history. People's family history is what it is.
Yeah.
You can counsel them on getting genetic testing or not. So there is a little bit of difference between the two, and perhaps maybe easier to protect genetic testing and maybe not family history, which people can't change anyway. So those are just some interesting things to think about as we consider how these might be addressed in different ways.
Yeah, well, I mean, and the thing, what springs to mind with me about that difference between genetics and family history is also the accessibility concerns. Most genetic studies start in primarily European populations. Things that are prevalent in European populations get discovered first. So you have a real issue where if it's based on, if you have protection for genetics, but not for family history, that would be genetic in many cases if you had the right sample and population that you studied it in. That's a really tricky one, because you definitely don't want to carve the non-European ancestry populations out of some predict through something like that.
Oh, for sure. But I think no one would, just because you have the gene implicated doesn't mean your family history wouldn't be relevant then. It's just that the act of testing would be protected, but whatever circumstances that you have otherwise are not, perhaps. Just some food for thought.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I'll try to get someone from Force or someone who is close to the Florida law and have that discussion. I think it's such an important one. And it's a case where the law just hasn't kept up with the changing technology, right? And it's creating all kinds of problems. And there are many other countries that have solved it. Although I think maybe solved is a little strong, but in the UK, for example, I believe Huntington's disease is carved out, right? It's the only thing that's not protected, is my understanding. So there's a problem there.
And very interestingly, it's like carved out with, they still can get a $500,000 life insurance policy or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So it's far from perfect. But I actually wanted to ask about, you mentioned Huntington's disease, and there's been a lot of work that's happened in that community. And I was curious what you learned from that community and the legacy and what you carried over, but also what things are different and what did you have to either unlearn or just consciously not apply as you thought about how you fight your fight here?
Mm-hmm. Well, we are so pleased to work in concert with many Huntington's disease activists. And I would also say with many adult onset genetic disorder activists. We actually are in the beginning stages of announcing a coalition group with leaders in the LRRK2 Parkinson's category, people with adult onset leukodystrophy, early onset Alzheimer's, dominantly inherited early onset Alzheimer's, Huntington's disease, and some others. Because I think many of the issues that impact us cut across these diseases, and our voice would, of course, be stronger together. On a practical level, Sest and BJ, two leaders in the Huntington's community, got connected to me through Daniel Barvin. And it was through them that I heard that they had a patient listening session scheduled with the FDA focused on the at-risk Huntington's disease community. And that inspired us to go and do the same. So that was a wonderful collaboration across the lines. Things that we need to be a little clear of on the difference between Huntington's and these genes that are implicated in ALS and FTD is the age of onset is quite variable in these ALS and FTD genes, whereas the age of onset is very predictable in Huntington's disease. The average age of disease onset in these diseases is much later in life, late 50s for C9, early 60s for some of the others. Some that are ALS linked can be quite early, like SOD1 and FUS, but there's a range. This is all zeroed in around 40. So there's a difference there. The disease course in Huntington's is quite long. People live 20 years after becoming symptomatic. In ALS, it's 3 years for C9 and a 7-year average for C9 FTD. So the time period where people are dealing with a symptomatic family member is much shorter. And the penetrance questions are a little bit more open in the ALS and FTD genes. It's almost certain that nearly all of them are not fully penetrant. It's a question on how not fully penetrant they are, whereas Huntington's is pretty much accepted to be fully penetrant. There's been a drug in ALS since 1995 that's disease modifying, and now there's two more. So there's no disease modifying therapies in Huntington's yet. Speaking with some people in affiliated levers of science, like somebody at the NIH and some other people, they cannot accept that there is a disease-modifying drug for ALS. It's really hard for them to accept that, because the implications of it are bad when you consider the genetic community. So I've had...
From a cost perspective or what? No.
Humanity, fairness, like... People are used to hearing about the symptom-modifying drugs in Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and Huntington's, which would not be relevant pre-symptomatically.
Right.
So it just feels very comfortable for some people to say, oh, no, it's a symptom-modifying drug. That's why you wouldn't use it earlier.
Yes, I see.
But it's a disease-modifying therapy. So that's a big difference.
Yeah, that makes sense. We mentioned these names a couple times, so I thought I'd just call out their episodes. You mentioned Daniel Barvin, who you co-founded and the legacy with. He was episode 54 of the podcast, actually, in 2021. So go back and have a listen to that. I think And the Legacy was being discussed and bubbling in the background, but hadn't yet been fully baked or launched yet. And then the other one is actually Michael Benatar, who was episode 121 that isn't out as of our recording right now, but will be out a few weeks before this one, and we talked about some of the similar issues, but actually quite a different conversation. I think a nice combination with this one, because it's obviously such an important problem that we have to solve. And it sounds like, I mean, he had a very similar perspective from you that for the, you know, for the last decade, a lot of people were saying, you know, these ideas about testing and treating people earlier were crazy and made no sense, but actually they proved to be exactly right and not crazy at all. But people like you and like him have been working on it for a long time and believed in that idea and didn't let people saying it was crazy stop you. And people gave you a hard time on Twitter many years ago, but there's a lot less of that now. It's probably hasn't gone away completely, but what has that been like? I think you've got a very strong personality. You're not afraid to get in and mix it up, but it must be a little bit frustrating at times to have people not appreciate where you're coming from and make it personal or make it difficult, right? When you're just trying to make a difference.
Yeah. And I have to say, you know, I have not experienced much unpleasantness from the scientific field at all. The only issue as a patient advocate is getting in the room.
Yeah.
You know, not being invited is not great, but you understand that folks don't want to have random people in these conversations. And I appreciate that, so I don't take it too personally. And through the hard work of our team, we are starting to get invited to things and participate in these conversations. So that's been a pleasure. In our role, on some level, the more personal or hot disputes may come more from our advocating for people who are being diagnosed in the future versus people who are suffering from the disease today. Although we care very much about the people suffering from the disease today, we are also thinking about the people diagnosed with the full phenotype in the future. And our defense of rational scientific inquiry and needing evidence to embrace the use of things does cause some uncomfortability for some of the people advocating for people living with ALS today who have a more expansive view of what should be allowed for the FDA to say works or what kind of evidence they might want to use. So I say that's more where the hard interactions might lie. But the scientific field is more about just getting in the conversation.
Right. Getting in the conversation. As we wrap up here, what can people do to help if they want to help you to make this progress faster? What sorts of things would be helpful?
Well, if you are impacted by genetic ALS and FTD, join the team. You can see more about us at endthelegacy.org, endthelegacy.org. For folks who are in the scientific field, be sure that when you're thinking about the landscape of ALS and FTD, you are considering the voice of the at-risk community and make sure that our say is heard in the development of your programs. And generally, spread the word.
Amazing. That's a perfect note to end on. Thank you, Gene. I really appreciate you taking the time, not just for the episode, but dedicating so much of your life to this important cause. I think you're going to look back in a few years and be amazed at how much you've accomplished with the help of everybody in the community.
Thank you so much.
And thanks everyone, as always, for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, as I say every single week, the thing that we'd really appreciate most from you is just share it with a friend or colleague or somebody that you think would enjoy it. And you can also leave us a review on your favorite podcast player. If you'd like to do that as well, every rating helps us get found by more people. So thanks again, and we'll see you next time.